Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The plaintiffs in this case directly purchased jumbo rolls of thermal facsimile paper from Appleton Papers. They purchased those rolls directly from Kanzaki Specialty Papers. They purchased those rolls directly from Eloff Hansen Paper and Board. And they purchased those rolls directly from Mitsubishi International Corporation. The plaintiffs are suing Nippon Papers solely for the damages caused by those direct purchases. Because the plaintiffs are not suing Nippon for any indirect purchases, Illinois Brick simply does not apply here. That point, together with black letter conspiracy law, which says that Nippon is jointly and severally liable as a co-conspirator for the direct sales of its co-conspirators, is the beginning and end of this case. Now, what does Nippon say? Nippon argues that this case should be dismissed because of the possibility that one of the parties would seek to introduce pass-on evidence to prove or disprove that Nippon was a member of the conspiracy. However, Nippon's rule is not the law. Every case that Nippon relies on for its rule was a decision interpreting Section 4 of the Clayton Act, which, of course, deals with the private treble damages remedy for litigants, for plaintiffs. Not a single one of Nippon's cases interprets Section 1 of the Sherman Act to also prohibit the use of pass-on evidence. Nor does Nippon make any effort to point to language in Section 1 of the Sherman Act that would create a prohibition against using pass-on evidence to prove whether a defendant was a member or not of a conspiracy. That's the first reason that Nippon's rule is not the law. The second reason is Nippon's rule would apply to all plaintiffs suing Nippon for being a member of the conspiracy. It would apply if the plaintiff were Nippon's trading house in Japan, which indisputably purchased Nippon paper directly from Nippon, because that type of plaintiff, no less than us, would have to prove that Nippon's a member of the conspiracy. If the government brought a criminal case against Nippon, Nippon's rule would apply to the government's case as well, because the government likewise would have to prove that Nippon was a member of the conspiracy. So Nippon's rule would require dismissal not just of this case, but of a government criminal case against Nippon, a direct purchaser of Nippon's paper, that case would have to be dismissed too. It's ironic indeed that Nippon relies on Illinois Brick for its rule, because Illinois Brick was guided by the long-standing policy of the federal courts to interpret the Clayton Act in a way to encourage private enforcement of the federal antitrust laws. Remember that the purpose of Illinois Brick giving the direct purchaser the sole right to collect the overcharge was to give that direct purchaser maximum incentive to enforce the federal antitrust laws. Nippon's rule, in direct contrast, would prohibit direct purchasers, indirect purchasers, the government, anyone from enforcing the antitrust laws against Nippon. So there's no support from Illinois Brick for Nippon's rule. In fact, the rationale for Illinois Brick contradicts that rule. The third reason that Nippon's rule cannot be the law is that the remedy that Nippon claims flows from its rule, dismissal of the entire case, cannot possibly be the appropriate remedy here. Even if Nippon were correct that pass-on evidence could not be used to prove whether or not Nippon was a member of the conspiracy, the remedy for that, of course, is to exclude that evidence. There is no reason that Nippon has given why, because a particular piece of evidence may be inadmissible in this case, that the entire case has to be dismissed. The fourth reason that Nippon's rule cannot be the law is that the, or I should, before I move on to the fourth point, corollary to the third point is the case would be dismissed under Nippon's rule before anyone knew whether any of the parties intended to introduce pass-on evidence on the issue of whether or not Nippon was a member of the conspiracy. There are many plausible scenarios, I submit, where neither party would introduce such evidence at trial. And in that situation, the case would be dismissed, even though ultimately that evidence would never be sought to be introduced at trial. The fourth reason that Nippon's rule cannot be the law is that the evidence that they claim requires dismissal is not even relevant. Nippon's argument is if our potential co-conspirators know that we, Nippon, cannot control prices in the United States, that Nippon cannot ensure that its U.S. trading house will raise prices in accordance with the conspiracy, then no one's going to bother to try to conspire with Nippon. And that's a defense, they say, to their participation in the conspiracy. But the relevant evidence to that argument is not whether some overcharge to Nippon's direct purchasers was passed on, but simply to look at the prices that Nippon's trading houses in the United States were charging. Because, for example, if Nippon's trading houses in the United States did not increase their prices in concert with the co-conspirators, then arguably, I think it would still have minimal, if any, relevance, but arguably that evidence would indicate that Nippon was not part of the conspiracy. You don't have to look at some overcharge analysis and see whether it was passed on. You simply look at the prices being charged by the U.S. trading houses of Nippon to see whether they're pricing in accordance with the conspiracy. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Can I ask one question? Why would that be relevant? I mean, why would the U.S. trading houses price at any other price, whether NPI was a member of the conspiracy or not? Fringe firms will price at the conspiracy price, you know, otherwise they're just giving away their money.
I entirely agree with that, Your Honor, and that's why I'm saying it would have minimal, if any, relevance, even in a best-case scenario. It would not in any way definitively prove or disprove Nippon's membership in the conspiracy.
I was getting worried that you thought one could prove a conspiracy by showing that people were charging the same price.
I understand, Your Honor, that fact alone has been held not to prove that someone is a member of a conspiracy.
That fact in combination with a lot of other facts. But anyway.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
I'm not going down that blind alley.
Mr. Simmons.
May it please the Court. Thank you, Your Honor. Ian Simmons for Nippon Paper. Members of the Court, this case presents a simple application of Illinois BRIC and as construed by the Supreme Court in the 1990 Utilicor case. There is no dispute as between the parties that the plaintiff certified class, which is explicitly defined to exclude Nippon sales, are indirect purchasers of Nippon paper. There is no dispute as to that. There is also no dispute, members of the Court, that Nippon paper only sold its paper in Japan through two sets of independent, non-co-conspirator intermediaries.
Counsel, I'm puzzled by what you just said. How does the class definition depend on sales? The class definition, I thought, included all those people who bought from the conspirators.
No, Your Honor. It is the plaintiffs have explicitly defined the class to include only those sales purchased directly from Nippon's alleged co-conspirators, which there are certain co-conspirators, Your Honor, that are vertically integrated, Appleton Paper and Kanzaki.
There's actually no reason why they couldn't be in the class, although they could opt out.
Correct, but they have explicitly excluded sales of Nippon from their class. That this is quite telling, Your Honor. There's also no dispute, Your Honor, that our intervening independent intermediaries through whom our paper was sold, and they made whatever price adjustments or non-price adjustments they saw fit, are not co-conspirators. I would direct the court to the Judge Posner's opinion in In Re Prescription Drugs, where Judge Posner explicitly states,
you know, it doesn't matter who writes the opinions of this court. That panel happened to include two of the members of the current panel, I believe. But it doesn't matter who writes or whether we're on the panel or not. Opinions speak for the court as an institution.
The court's opinion in the prescription drug members of the court, I respectfully suggest, is controlling. There the court held that you can get at the level one. If we posit four levels of firms, level one are the Japanese manufacturers. Levels two and three encompass two sets of independent downstream entities as to Nippon Paper. Level four are the is the certified class. There is no dispute that Nippon Paper, in this case, was only sold through two intervening levels of independent firms. The court's opinion in prescription drugs says if the plaintiffs had evidence and allege that those
independent... Let me ask you, or at least reveal to you what my problem is with this line of argument. That you seem to be assuming that NPI could be liable only to its own customers. But given the norm of joint and several liability, NPI is liable to anybody who purchases from any conspirator for the whole overcharge of the entire conspiracy. And that overcharge includes sales which are direct to the plaintiffs. So unless we abrogate the rule of joint and several liability for cases where there are indirect purchasers, how does the existence of these indirect purchasers bear on the plaintiff's recovery? Because they claim they purchased directly from members of the conspiracy and that your client is jointly and severally liable.
Your Honor, I can Hanover Shoe and Illinois Brick. Illinois Brick explicitly states that Hanover, the principal basis of the opinion in Hanover Shoe was to prevent the tracing of downstream price effects. Now, Your Honor, the plaintiffs cannot cite one case in which joint and several liability turned on non-dealing indirect alleged conspirators. In other words, Judge Seitz's opinion, they cite the Boghossian opinion. Judge Seitz, in that case...
You're losing me. I don't know what non-dealing indirect...
Let me give the court an example. The court's example, joint and several liability as to a price-fixing case, kicks in as follows. If we posit two levels to reconcile it with Illinois Brick, level one and level two, if there are five firms that fix the price of widgets, and Ian Simmons purchases only from firm number five, the widget, but I am a direct purchaser, the law of joint and several says I can sue all five
all
or any
five
of the... Correct.
...for the entire conspiracy overcharge.
Precisely, Your Honor. Now, switch that to non-dealing, but there are intervening independent economic actors as to one of the conspirators that break the chain of causation. Recall, Mr. Small says, he says that our argument
you're
would...
You're losing me. What I understand Illinois Brick to say, maybe I'm a bad person to interpret Illinois Brick because I was a losing lawyer in Illinois Brick. I represented the United States in that case, and its position lost. But putting to one side the fact that I may not understand the case, what it says is that the property right in the recovery belongs to the direct purchaser. Now, your direct purchasers are other than the plaintiffs. So the only person who owns the right to recover for whoever bought directly from NPI
would be our immediate trading house.
Well, whoever that person is. So nobody other than that person can recover that amount. But I don't see why their ownership, why your trading house's ownership of that particular recovery right defeats a recovery right that is otherwise held by third parties. It's a recovery right that depends on joint and several liability, but it's a right that they own because they are the direct purchasers for portions of the output in this industry.
Your Honor, the complaint in this case, and the point I was going to make on my widget example, the whole theory of joint and several liability in a direct relationship is that had there not been lockstep pricing or going along pricing by the alleged conspirators, some of those non-dealing but direct conspirators would have cheated and lowered the price, etc. Now, Illinois Brick and indeed the Supreme Court in Utilicor, in which it was admitted, it was undisputed, that the utility companies passed on 100% of the alleged price increase by the natural gas companies. The Supreme Court nevertheless said Illinois Brick rule is hard and fast, as the court noted in the Carter case. It is a stark rule. It is a rule of standing under Section 4 of the Clayton Act, not Section 1 of the Sherman Act.
Rule of ownership. Who owns the recovery right? The answer is the direct purchaser.
It is also, Your Honor, a question.
Our plaintiffs, the appellants in this case, are direct purchasers. And therefore, the question is, what rights do they own? Do they own only a right against the firms from which they bought directly, or do they own it on a theory of joint and several liability against all alleged co-conspirators?
Your Honor, they do not own it as to Nippon Paper. Section 4 of the Clayton Act is also a question of proximate cause. That what the Supreme Court sought to avoid in Hanover Shoe and Illinois Brick was a tracing question. The theory, as the plaintiffs in this case, that whatever Nippon Paper did back in Japan to maintain that level 4 price, the whole theory of it, if you look, Your Honor, at app page 6, which I believe is paragraph 19 of the complaint, that what we did in Japan caused the price fix here in the United States. That would require tracing through 4 steps of intervening decision-making. Hanover Shoe and Illinois Brick.
Why,
Your Honor? Because
suppose there's a theory that, let's say Dell and Compaq and Gateway get together and they fix the price of computers. Some of them sell directly to customers, some of them sell through lots of intermediaries. But it doesn't matter whether they sell through intermediaries, the price to customers will be affected by the cartel at the manufacturing level.
Not, Your Honor, if those intermediaries were not co-conspirators and absorbed the price change and did not pass it on. Your Honor, in other words,
you're asking us to suspend the laws of economics.
No, Your Honor. Illinois Brick and Hanover Shoe said you don't inquire. It's not a defense to say that the person immediately below me passed it on, therefore they don't have standing under Section 4. We don't inquire as to whether one way or another there is pass on. I would direct the court.
The only way it could not be passed on is if the intermediate markets were themselves not competitive.
Your Honor, then that's exactly.
Otherwise, they're pricing down to marginal cost in the intermediate markets.
Your Honor, that's
the problem in Illinois Brick was the difficulty of showing elasticity of demand in a market. And that is not entailed by the plaintiff's case here. It's not necessary to show the elasticity in order to show the harm.
Your Honor, I think Illinois Brick stated as follows at page 725, quoting from and referring to Hanover Shoe, quote, "The principal basis for the decision in Hanover Shoe was the court's perception of the uncertainties and difficulties in analyzing price and output decisions in the real economic world rather than an economist's hypothetical model." Either one way or the other, Your Honors, this case is reversed, which it should not be. We pass on evidence will absorb this case, and that's what it will be about. Whether two independent firms passed on any price increase, whether they absorbed it or whatever, and that is precisely the rule Illinois Brick and Hanover Shoe, as ratified by the Supreme Court in the 1990 Utilicor opinion, where it was effectively stipulated that 100% of the pass-on had occurred to the indirect level, and yet they sought to sue the level one, the natural gas company. The Supreme Court said it is a stark rule, I'm paraphrasing from this court's opinion in Carter, only the direct purchasers have standing to sue. That would be our trading house, not these plaintiffs. And the way to reconcile joint and several liability, Your Honors, with Illinois Brick is where the...
It is clear that only your trading house can sue for that portion of the market output that your trading house bought. The other buyers can sue for that portion of the market output that they bought.
But
and then we get into joint and several liability.
Your Honor, by definition, we can't be jointly and several if our trading houses are not... We did not sell through any named intermediary. That is
that's
the
where you come back to.
But that's
you have to demonstrate that your liability in this conspiracy cannot be joint and several.
Well, that's what we are arguing, and that's what the court's opinion of prescription drugs. This is just an application of prescription drugs. Prescription drugs says the pharmacies, level 3, can sue the drug manufacturers, level 1, if they join and name as defendants, as the co-conspirators, the level 2 wholesalers. If you draw a circle around, you now have standing. The level 3 indirect have standing, even to sue the non-dealing indirect level 1 manufacturers. They have admitted, and it is undisputed, that our intervening firms, our level 2 and 3, are not co-conspirators. and yet they want to maintain the suit against us. It has flatly barred your, I see my time is up. I would urge the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Small?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. What opposing counsel has said would have some applicability if we were suing Nippon for its sales of paper indirectly to the plaintiff. But of course, we are not. We are only suing Nippon for its co-conspirators' direct sales to the plaintiffs. The fact that we happen to also have purchased Nippon paper indirectly is incidental. It does not in any way deprive us of the right to sue for direct purchases. And under clear conspiracy law, which says that Nippon is jointly and severally liable for whatever damage the conspiracy caused to us, Nippon is liable for the damage caused by the direct sales to us of its co-conspirators. That's the beginning and end of this appeal. We have cited cases to this court where plaintiffs have not purchased at all from a particular co-conspirator, and yet that co-conspirator is still jointly and severally liable for the damage caused by its co-conspirator's sale to the plaintiff. So if a plaintiff can recover from a co-conspirator with which it had no dealings, forget about indirect, then certainly the fact that we happen to have bought indirectly from Nippon here is irrelevant to the question of whether we can recover for the direct purchases from its co-conspirators. The last point I'd like to make is this is a dramatic shift that Nippon would like to make in this case to impose a rule decided under Section 4 of the Clayton Act, which says you can't use pass-on evidence to prove or disprove damages, to then say that you can't use pass-on evidence to prove someone's membership in a conspiracy under Section 1 of the Sherman Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Small. Our thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.